excusez-moi d'abord de ne pas intervenir en français. On a eu cette petite discussion ici sur le français. J'ai même passé la licence à la Sorbonne. J'ai toujours été très capable d'intervenir en français. Mais comme je le pratique trop peu jusqu'ici, ça fait plus. Je parlerai en anglais. Yes, thanks a lot for the invitation and also kind of following the introduction by Sabine. I have to say I will speak as a political philosopher here, so not so much as a kind of historian or political scientist looking at the 20s, but rather looking at Kirchheim and Neumann kind of from a somewhat more systematic perspective, picking up on some of the issues Bill raised yesterday, but also picking up, you will see a lot on Marcus's reflections on republicanism, but defending maybe something like a Marxist republicanism, we will see. Okay. At the end of 2011, American President Barack Obama and Congress fought about the National Defense Authorization Act. The most contentious element of this act was that it contained the right of the American military to indefinitely detain American citizens even within the US without any due process. Obama objected to this licensing of the military, but Congress was not willing to remove this provision. Shortly before the expiration of the old NDAA, on December 31st, 2011, Obama signed the act, but added a long public statement. In this statement, he explained that signing the act was necessary to continue funding for the military and its personnel, and to extend security programs which were about to expire. With regard to the indefinite detention of American citizens, he declared, "I want to clarify, quote, I want to clarify that my administration will not authorize the indefinite military detention without trial of American citizens. Indeed, I believe that doing so would break with our most important traditions and values as a nation. My administration will interpret section 1021 in a manner that ensures that any detention it authorizes complies with the Constitution, the laws of war, and all other applicable law." So Obama promises to interpret the new law in light of other constitutional and legal provisions. But by the very act of adding his statement, he underlines that there is no necessity to interpret the NDAA and the authorities it grants to the administration in this way. Interestingly, he does not tie his promise to interpret the NDAA in the aforementioned way to the rule of law, legal coherence, or inalienable rights of citizens, but to his belief that indefinitely detaining American citizens would break national traditions and values. He thus binds the legal rights of American citizens who might be considered possible terrorists to his understanding of traditions and values underpinning the American polity, and not to the American Constitution and the political and legal system it establishes, and which include, obviously, the office of the president. In several talks, I have used the signing of the NDAA with this accompanying statement as an example of a major shift in current law and politics away from classically modern theories of legitimate government. Both Republican and liberal political theorists have assumed that political rule, if it is supposed to be legitimate, is constituted by those who are subject to the rule, and this means by the citizens. There's a chain of legitimation where a government is constituted and empowered by citizens, and can thus, as Locke and others succeeding him have pointed out, never have more power than the citizens before the Constitution. If before the Constitution nobody had a right to unilaterally decide on the fate of others, and this means especially on the exclusion from joining a system of public law, this right can also not accrue to the government. The NDAA as such is already a violation of this chain of legitimation because it attributes to the executive the right to decide if certain citizens dispose or can continue to dispose of fundamental civic rights, most importantly due process rights, or not. Obama, while attempting to attenuate the act, really reinforces its logic by promising that his administration would not apply the law to American citizens because this would violate national traditions and values. He makes utterly clear that in the executive's view, the rule of law depends on the will and the beliefs of the president and not vice versa. The reaction to this example and discussion was often very puzzling to me. Most agreed that this was not good law, but especially, even though not only lawyers objected,
that I should not take these political statements and strategies too seriously. There would be court cases, they predicted, where judges would come to the conclusion that the NDAA could not be valid law in its section 1021, and as a consequence, the chain of legitimation embodied in the legal system would prevail over the attempt to legitimate the abrogation of fundamental civic rights by pointing to the necessities of the security state. Discussions after talks are not well suited for the full exposition of argument, which is why I can only guess that people bringing forward this objection would argue in one of two ways. They would either stress the deep roots of the legal system in the American society and political order, and deny the possibility that single legislative or executive acts could destroy the legal system and its key characteristics, thereby pointing to an extra legal foundation or dimension of the legal system, but considering this foundation to be largely withdrawn from or immune to current political controversies and the attempt to politicize the application of law. Or they would say that classically modern political theory has not only argued for a certain conception of legitimacy, which could be adopted or not, instead it has uncovered requirements for government without which government as such would lose its binding force. It could not conceive of itself as the government of its citizens anymore. It would be something, some more or less brute force, which could only expect compliance if it either matches the interests of those subject to the force or if it is sufficiently strong to override these interests. We're certainly not yet at a point where the rule of law is generally at risk. Juridification is still an important feature of economic development, and one can also still observe the power of constitutionalist argumentations in many legal and political domains. But the example introduced before, as well as other developments, for instance in migration law, which I think is even more, it's even stronger, listening to the radio this morning about discussions in Germany, where assumptions on the illegality of border crossings and strategies to withhold legal status determination processes abound, indicate that we should consider more closely the factors deciding on the maintenance or not of the rule of law. Is the rule of law the expression of a particular constellation of social and political forces which might be changing at any moment? Or is the rule of law a resilient factor at the foundation of social and political conflicts which shapes, channels, and limits them in important ways? And if the rule of law is resilient, what does this mean for the possibility of politics? These questions are, this now brings me to Kirchheim and Neumann, are very similar to issues which left politicians and scholars discussed in Germany in the 1920s and 30s. Even though many legal, especially transnational and international legal developments, as well as transformations in constitutional thought have occurred since then, it makes sense to return to the discussion of the 20s and 30s and the analyses and normative positions they brought forward. Often they are considered as controversies about the normativity of law, the normativity of the rule of law. My perspective will be different. I'm interested in diagnoses on the reasons for the existence and maintenance of the rule of law and conclusions drawn from the view that there is no rule of law anymore or that it has unacceptable consequences. Looking at the 1920s and 30s is interesting because here we are dealing with a generation of scholars and political or legal theorists who are not as naturally as we often do taking the rule of law for granted. Okay, so I will start with Kirchheimer and then move on to Neumann. So in her magisterial reconstruction of Marxist theories of law, Sonja Buckel observes that Kirchheimer did not develop, and Neumann neither, did not develop a general theory of law. Especially in his early writings, he was very much preoccupied with developments in the late Weimar Republic, and some even directly involved in political controversies within the SPD. Kirchheimer's assessments of law thus also always depend on strategic and political perspectives in the respective controversies, and Bill, in his study on Kirchheimer and Neumann, ascribes to both of them primarily a wrong normative, namely Schmittian perspective on law, which gives them wrong clues when they try to understand the political and legal reality of their time. In what follows, I will argue that Kirchheimer does indeed not develop a general theory of law, but that one important reason for this is his diagnosis of the conditions which must be given for law to be an organizing element in political and social reality. This diagnosis, I would argue, is not primarily based on a wrong conception of law, but on empirical observations which test the existence of something like the rule of law. question at the end will be if the diagnosis warrants the normative and strategic proposals, or more generally, which is the relationship between empirical diagnosis and normative attitudes on the rule of law. So proponents of the rule of law typically do not deny that it has a history and came about in specific historic developments. But this history is often presented as a process of discovery entailing some real progress in the history of mankind, which is why the specific reasons for the development can ultimately be disregarded. Kirchhammer draws a different perspective, a picture of the emergence of the rule of law and its implications for the more general existence and maintenance of the rule of law. In different articles, most prominently at the beginning of his dissertation, or the published version of his dissertation, Kirchhammer points out that the claim to the rule of law has its origin in the struggle between the bourgeoisie and the nobility over government and its exercise. Since the bourgeoisie did not directly aim at taking over government itself, its long quarrels with the nobility took on the form of an attempt to control the nobility's exercise of government by means of law and to program government with its own economic interests in view. The bourgeoisie thus wanted, according to Kirchheimer, a form and content of government suitable for its economic interests, but it did not strive for taking over government itself. This limited engagement of the bourgeoisie in its struggle with the nobility extended the struggle into the 19th century. At this point in time, a second struggle became more and more important, namely the struggle between workers and the bourgeoisie. The latter two classes reunited against nobility and converged, despite their different interests, in the claim of negative freedom. This means in the claim not to be dominated by others in their view and in their rights to be politically active. The rule of law, and also democracy, especially in their control aspects, resulted from this shared negative interest in not being dominated by another third class. Current research on republicanism and the rule of law would very likely contest Kirchhammer's history of the rule of law, its very particular focus on Germany, France, and Britain. It would point to older roots of the idea of the rule of law in the political and legal order of ancient Rome, and then especially in the northern Italian cities in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance. But this research would not necessarily reject the core of Kirchhammer's reconstruction, namely that the rule of law and democracy were primarily established to check rulers or a ruling class who are not understood to be the representatives of those who are aiming at the checks. It is thus correct to argue that the rule of law did emerge as a response to struggles over government and the attempt to limit the reach of governmental powers. But if democracy and the rule of law secure non-domination, why shouldn't this be some kind of progress on which future forms of government should rest and which they should not question or endanger? For Kirchhammer, the negative program largely loses its meaning once the power of the nobility is broken. The conflict to which the rule of law was the solution was the conflict between the nobility who exercised government and the bourgeoisie, and later the workers, who were subject to government, had an interest in its exercise, but did not want to take it over themselves. After the end of this conflict, the content of democracy and the rule of law, and especially also their relationship, become problematic since they are not embedded in or related to a specific conflict anymore. The question is now how and why democracy and the rule of law should continue to bind workers and the bourgeoisie to common procedures and solutions. Bourgeois authors offer two interpretations of the given situation, aiming at explaining the binding character of the rule of law, which are both unacceptable for Kirchhammer. First, they present the political commonality in the struggle against the nobility as a social commonality and invent the people as a socially homogeneous entity. The content and program of democracy and law would directly flow from the people, which is no longer characterized primarily by classes and their struggles. Anything which captures this people is democratic per se, since it expresses its will. For Kirchhammer, this interpretation is unacceptable because it camouflages the real conflicts in society and depoliticizes politics. The common fight for the rule of law has thus not brought about a classless society which would need to and could organize itself democratically using law as the medium of this self-organization. The second interpretation, bourgeois authors, as you bring forward, presents the current common order as one of mere political equality. According to this view, the political order does not imply any particular social program, and any decision taken within it is nothing but a decision of those who are politically equal and who are each counted in the decisions. Democracy and the rule of law thus provide a framework for the peaceful and structured continuation of the class struggle where each has the same weight in the decisions. For Kirchheimer, such a suggestion could have been enough in the coordination between the bourgeoisie and the proletarians in their common fight against the nobility, but it is insufficient for positive forms of government. Why, he asks, should anybody accept the decisions of a majority if there is no common project underlying government and its exercise? Understanding democracy and the rule of law as a common framework presupposes in this second interpretation that class struggles are a kind of common project leading to results which are in some sense good or at least acceptable for all. Such a presupposition, which, we will later see, Neumann is willing to defend for prior phases of the rule of law, would deny the reality of the conflicts in question and assume that there is some more basic interest of all to prevent these conflicts from taking on certain violent forms. Such an interest, Kirchheimer argues, could only emerge if either people assumed that they could never definitely win in these conflicts, this means if any solution would lead to new violent conflicts, or if one could observe the readiness of others in conflicts to uphold a certain form of peaceful struggle, even if this would lead to their defeat in the conflict. For Kirchheimer, both conditions do not hold. The proletariat can see the possibility to win the class struggle with the bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie decides to not observe the rule of law and democracy if such adherence resulted in major difficulties for the realization of its interests. So democracy and the rule of law emerge as major instruments in the struggle between the nobility on the one hand and the alliance between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat on the other hand. Once this struggle was definitely won by the latter two classes, in Germany at the end of World War I, in France already in the middle of the 19th century, the necessity to fight against attempts of domination by third classes does not simply disappear. Kirchheimer acknowledges the tendency of bureaucracy to constitute itself as a new class with the pretension to rule the other classes. Upholding and using the rule of law, and especially democracy, continue thus to be important for controlling administrations. But this negative reason for the rule of law and democracy is relatively weak, and it does not say much on many of the conflicts arising between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat and the ensuing interests in political steering. For Kirchheimer, as was said before, the main issue is that we would have to understand why the losing side in democratic, majoritarian, or in court decisions should have reasons to abide by these decisions. If there are real conflicts between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, both aim for the realization of their interests in these conflicts and assume that such realization is possible, why or when would they accept a conflict solution mechanism which might require them to renounce obtaining their aims? Ever since Hobbes, liberalism used individualism to develop an answer to this question. Since no individual can claim stable power over others, all have a higher interest in the establishment of a common framework where in the pursuit of their interests they do not depend on their individual power anymore. The rule of law and its binding character directly follow from this higher interest. For Kirchheimer, following Marx in his criticism of Hegel, this abstract individualism misrepresents essential conflicts and the collective character of interests and class struggles. Given that there are more or less organized collectives involved in class struggles, they do not have to assume that they will not be able to claim stable power over others. Therefore, the basic liberal prudential argument for the rule of law is not convincing. Kirchheimer also discusses the non-prudential version of normative individualism, developed from Locke to Kant, which provides individuals with normative status and authority and infers the rule of law and democracy and their binding character from this authority. In an interesting reconstruction and critique of human rights, he argues that they were, in fact, a major driving force in the French Revolution and for the extension of statehood in the early 19th century, not just as the negative rejection of domination, but as positive claims. In the 19th century, however, they lost their programmatic force and became an instrument in the class struggle between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. The former used, or abused, human rights to protect their claims to property and security, and denied any more substantial social and political implications of human rights. Since these social and political claims would have been more fundamental in the perspective of the proletariat and a precondition for the value of rights to property and security, This distinction between different admissible and inadmissible claims undermined the bindingness of what was established by human rights. They were not the safeguards for some underlying general individual normative authority anymore, but an instrument denying some the exercise of such authority. This criticism of human rights already points to Kirchheimer's solution to the question why and when the rule of law and democracy should and could be binding to those who lose in democratic and court decisions. All those subject to the rule of law and democracy must see them as a common project, and the commonality of the project would transform losing in the struggle into collective choices in a common undertaking. The best example for such collective decision procedures can be found in political parties. In any party, there is discussion about the best strategies to reach its aims, and there might even be debate about the aims the party should reach. But all in the party, maybe even wrongly, assume that it pursues a superior collective aim, and that this aim is strong enough to bind people to decisions, even if they are convinced that these decisions are wrong or even detrimental to achieving their aim. In parties, this aim does not necessarily precede the existence of the party, but typically forming a party is not an aim in itself. Members in a party usually presuppose that they share certain interests and that this sharing explains why they form a party. Even if member interests are significantly shaped by deliberation and negotiation within a party, the members will conceive of themselves as having an interest in being a member of this party, where this latter interest is not only generated within the party. The bindingness of party decisions thus ultimately depends on some objective commonality. This means some commonality which does not strictly depend on the commonality established by the party. For Kirchheimer, this is the challenge for any rule of law democracy in a situation of class struggle. In such a situation, there is very limited commonality, and decisions are thus seen primarily not in light of a presumably common project, but as expressions of particular interests in the struggle. Here, constitutions acquire a new role. Historically, they were attempts to frame and control the exercise of government by others. But after the end of this struggle, constitutions can be used to express a common project that is sufficiently strong to establish the binding character of the rule of law and of democracy. In Kirchheimer's view, the Weimar Constitution failed in expressing such a common project. And this failure tells a lot about the requirements for such a common project to be successful. In the Schmittian terminology, but I'm offering here obviously a reading that is saying it's not Schmittian, it's a different undertaking here. In the Schmittian terminology, for which many criticize him, Kirchheim objects to the Weimar Constitution that it does not clearly state a specific will for the German polity. The Weimar Constitution certainly contains many substantial aims and even an interesting set of social rights, before we heard about this yesterday, but putting together ultimately competing aims and rights in a single constitution is insufficient for establishing a common project. The weakness of the will of the Weimar Constitution is thus not its circumvention of sovereignty and the belief in politics as a decision between friend and foe. The will is structurally weak because the constitution does not contain a solution to possible collisions between the aims and rights. It postpones the decision in these collisions, and this also means that there is no common project, but only the attempt to assemble major issues that are at stake in the class struggle in a common document. This is certainly more than brute class struggle, and it documents some acknowledgement of contested topics, but it still leaves the class struggle as the major factor deciding how all those subjected to the rule of law and democracy relate to the options they offer. For Kirchheimer, the consequence is obvious. There is no rule of law and democracy in the proper sense. They serve as instruments in the prolonged class struggle, and the workers' movement should not misconceive of the given realities. Since the bourgeoisie will ultimately not be bound by the rule of law and democracy if they run contrary to its interests, the proletariat should first expect violations and abuses of the rule of law and democracy, and second, not tie itself to the rule of law and democracy if they are major obstacles in its fight for socialism. It would be wrong, I would argue, to attribute a certain concept of law to Kirchheimer and to view his take on the rule of law and democracy only as the application of this concept to a specific historic situation. Admittedly, within the very limited perspective of the history of the rule of law in recent German history, he reconstructs reasons for the establishment of some kind of rule of law and examines the depth and scope of this rule of law given changing social and political circumstances. His suggestions for a socialist strategy when dealing with possible violations of the rule of law and democracy reflect the weak hold of law onto reality, and not primarily a political and conceptual agenda which denies normative requests for the rule of law and democracy. And I will now kind of briefly summarize that. I think kind of one can obviously now make several objections to Kirchheimer, and I think the obvious objections is that he assumes way too strong objective convergence in the interests in the proletariat, in the bourgeoisie. He does not kind of acknowledge that there are many more conflicts in society where kind of the rule of law could play an important role. And he also kind of does not really consider the kind of the organizing force of law also for the class struggle. Yeah? So this is definitely that he might be too Schmittian or too activist in a certain perspective. Okay, let me come to my second, much briefer part on Neumann. So often Franz Neumann is discussed before Kirchheimer, since he's a little older and much more directly involved in legal conflicts during the Weimar Republic than Kirchheimer. But systematically, I would argue, following really kind of what Bill was saying yesterday, it makes sense to consider Neumann's analysis of the rule of law after Kirchheimer's, because Neumann grants law more autonomy and resilience than Kirchheimer, and this already in the 20s and 30s. He responds to some of the objections I've just mentioned and assumes a deeper anchoring of law in society than the younger legal theorists. But he still joins Kirchheimer in his diagnosis that this deeper anchoring can be, and was during the Weimar Republic, insufficient for the continued validity of law under changing circumstances. For Neumann, the modern success of law is intimately tied to the necessity of the state. Modernity, and especially modern capitalism, we've heard about this yesterday, consist in their core in liberating non-moral autonomy. People primarily relate to themselves and their interests and act as the legislators of their actions. If somebody wants to lead the life of a successful businessman, he can organize his life, on purpose I choose he here, he can organize his life accordingly and take the decisions required for this. This becomes an important driving force for modern capitalism and its assumption that each person could succeed in her striving for her aims. And here I think kind of the Weberian Marxism is already there in the late 20s, early 30s. At the same time, it liberates agents from pre-established social or religious obligations and is thus a major factor in generating conflicts between different agents. There's no reason why one should or could assume that the aims autonomous beings pursue will ultimately be compatible and could easily be integrated into one harmonious unity. The crucial factor for the capitalist dynamics is thus always also a major threat for peaceful coexistence. And this also means for the very dynamics of capitalism itself. So paradoxically, the liberation of agents to autonomous beings requires them to subject themselves to a third agent powerful enough to prevent conflicts from becoming destructive for the whole. Therefore, the state is the necessary complement to social and cultural modernization. Obviously, beings claiming autonomy will not simply subject themselves to another being claiming the highest power to decide for them in their conflicts. This is the first reason, according to Neumann, picks up the argumentation of non-Hobbesian social contract theories for the emergence of the rule of law. If a state could be able to rule autonomous beings, it must be a non-arbitrary structure itself. Its agency must be strictly tied to some rules which first allow other agents to know in advance when and how the state will interfere into their actions, and second, gives these agents the ability to control the exercise of state power by checking its convergence with the rules. Since the state is not a natural entity, its existence and operation, and this means primarily its ability to exercise coercion, ultimately depends on its acceptance and justification. A second reason for the rule of law, Neumann adds, that given possible conflicts and the self-regarding character of autonomous beings, they need more regulation than only state interference in their main conflicts. The rule of law can provide guidelines for autonomous beings in their social and economic relationships by establishing forms like contracts or rights which tell them under which conditions they can expect what from other agents. Rules are not only necessary for the justification of the state, but also as means for structuring and maintaining social and economic interaction. This means coordination and cooperation. So here Neumann responds to one of the criticisms on Kirchheimer I've mentioned before. Law might be primarily of instrumental value for agents in their conflicts, but given certain circumstances, and this means here the necessity to coordinate and cooperate with others in the pursuit of one's aims, the instrument is constitutive for higher levels of social interaction. Agents can thus not simply reject the instrument in reaching for particular goals, since they would lose more comprehensive abilities to pursue complex aims. And Neumann goes even so far to acknowledge the liberal normative core of the rule of law. But, so following Weber, for Neumann, the main dynamics behind early capitalism is the emancipation from traditional social, cultural, and religious context and their authority. Capitalist activity depends on agents who relate to themselves and the determination of the ends they want to pursue and the means they use to pursue these ends. This emancipation leads to unavoidable conflicts and thus also to the emergence of the state as the arbiter in these conflicts. The rule of law is, on the one hand, the condition for the state to serve as the arbiter, while on the other hand, it also establishes a new and formally egalitarian framework for social relationships, which transcends the egoism supposedly at the origin of the rule of law. One could thus assume that even though the rule of law has a particular history, it constitutes a new kind of social and political order, which is self-sustaining and also able to counter tendencies or inclinations to not abide to the rule of law. Neumann agrees that this was true for some time, but he points out that one major factor has changed at the beginning of the 20th century. Under conditions of concurrent capitalism, heard this already yesterday in some sense, under conditions of concurrency capitalism, some level of real equality and dependency on others was the reason for the necessity of the state. No agent could assume to be able to maintain herself in a stable, dominating position. This has changed with monopoly capitalism. Now agents have emerged who are, in many respects, sufficiently big that they can assume such stable domination. In difference to Kirchhoff, Neumann does not think that these big agents simply disregard law and recklessly pursue their interests. He rather argues, and that's why I think the argument is much better than Kirchhoff's argument, he rather argues that the specific properties of the rule of law serve and can serve a different purpose under these new circumstances. Instead of establishing a level playing field where all have to negotiate and coordinate with others to pursue their aims, under conditions of monopoly capitalism, major agents can use the rule of law to reject attempts of others to control them or set a common agenda. The rule of law thus becomes a setting where one side, which is economically and socially dominating the other side, can use the rule of law to control this other side in its attempts at controlling or influencing the first. Given the independence of the social and economic realms from legally controlled coordination and cooperation, the mutual control through the rule of law becomes a factor preventing social and economic policies from transforming the social world and the economy. The rule of law might still be strong, even under these changed circumstances, but its strength is now not something of equal value for all anymore. Accepting the rule of law will mean for the workers' movement to give up at least some of its substantial aims. Like Kirchhoff, Neumann assumes that the new role of the rule of law was already clear to all relevant agents at the end of World War I. The Weimar Constitution was thus no simple step in the evolution of the rule of law in Germany. It was the attempt to renegotiate the rule of law by setting standards and principles, and this means most of all by establishing social rights, which serve as some kind of political program for the agents subject to the rule of law. But because of its overly formal character, judges could use the formal requirements of law to counteract policies trying to implement the constitutional contract or compromise. What needs reconsideration is the relationship between the formal requirements for the rule of law and the use of law as an implementation mechanism for social and economic policies. So here I think now Neumann is confronted with kind of two equally unattractive options, and he has to choose between the two options. So I think it's something beyond the divide with kind of a general critique on the formality of law on the one hand and a general endorsement of the rule of law. I think he wants to argue that kind of there is a situation where the rule of law, despite the fact that many important normative arguments speak in the favor of the rule of law, it is still being used in a situation of strong economic and social inequality as a tool to prevent kind of the workers' movement from controlling the economy and society. Okay, I come to the end. So I began this paper by looking at the NDAA in 2011 and the authorization of the American president it contains to indefinitely detain American citizens. This violates the rule of law because it reverses the chain of legitimation implied by the rule of law and transforms the rule of law at best into rule by law. The rule of law presupposes law as the precondition for any exercise of government and therefore also of legal statuses of each person who is subject to this government. Because without such an independent legal status, she could not control that the exercise of government is bound by law. If those who are exercising government can deprive persons arbitrarily of their legal status, we are thus returning to the rule of man and giving up the rule of law. Some contest such legal developments, but are ultimately convinced that the legal system will correct these abuses of the rule of law and uphold the requirements for the rule of law. I've raised the question why and when we should think that this will be the case. Which are the factors deciding on the existence and maintenance of the rule of law? Kirchheimer and Neumann suggest two interestingly different answers to these questions. For Kirchheimer, the rule of law depends either on a situation where political and social or economic power is distributed over different classes, which still need the other classes and cannot simply extinguish them, or on a situation where different classes pursue a sufficiently common project. In the first situation, the rule of law is primarily negative and aims at securing that the exercise of government is not used to dominate any of the other classes, whereas in the second situation, the rule of law is primarily positive and consists in the implementation of a common agenda. For Neumann, the rule of law requires some basic social and economic equality, with the result that most depend on others, both with regard to the protection from them, but also in the projects they pursue. Under conditions of inequality, the rule of law can continue to operate negatively, but then it has at least also the effect of cementing and protecting differences in social and economic power. Kirchheimer and Neumann considered the rule of law in light of the political project they were primarily pursuing, socialism. So couldn't we say that our problem is not theirs, or at least not as big as theirs? We want to uphold the rule of law in its defensive generality. Nobody should be subjected to the decisions of others without having a legal status herself. This is not yet claiming something positive for her. It is certainly easier to see the resilience of the negative dimensions of the rule of law. But the problem, I would argue, in our current situation is even deeper. Some are excluded by law with the argumentation that this is necessary to uphold the rule of law. Here, the migration issue is obviously in my mind. States and governments are not simply withdrawing their support for the rule of law. They use, I would say, an emptied formal conception of the rule of law to justify why some cannot claim the same legal status than others. There is no formality as such which is resilient and which we could count on. The formality is rather used as an instrument. Okay, I will conclude here. I think that's enough to present. Thank you.